America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome, everybody. Glad to have you back. Coming to you live from the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Another day of the Health America 2008. This year it's called Health Action Conference. And we got several great guests coming up for you today. We hope you'll enjoy the program. There's a lot to talk about. Of course, yesterday and today, this most important conference taking place here about healthcare in America. I watched a good bit of the Republican debate last night. Didn't hear much about healthcare on there. It's something that evidently they want to shove right under the rug, and that's why we're here over this important two-day conference, to make sure that healthcare is brought to the forefront. It's one of the most important issues facing all families in this country today, and it's got to be solved. I talked to Governor Mark Warner yesterday, mentioned that in the neighborhood of $7,500 for every man, woman, and child in America being spent on healthcare. And as we all know, it's not working. $7,500, enormous profits for the insurance companies, enormous profits for the healthcare industry itself. And something has to be done. And I also got a chance to talk to Tom Daschle this morning and asked the question, realistically, do you think that everything the politicians are talking about, whether it be single payer, whether it be universal, do you think that realistically that the healthcare problem can be solved anytime soon? What do you think? And everybody seems to think that if we get a Democratic president and the Congress is okay, we get a bigger majority in Congress, everybody seems to think that we can indeed get this off the ground rather quickly, within a few months, 6 months. Getting it passed will be one thing. Getting a health care plan implemented, of course, will be quite another. So we'll be talking about that for a couple of hours. We'll be here from 3 to 5 today, and we've got some guests coming up. We're waiting for our first guest to come up right now. It's pandemonium at these things, and we'll wait for him to bring our guest around. We've got, in the first hour today, we've got Andrea Schlesinger. She's the executive director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy. Very interesting organization. Pat Rogner coming up at 3:30, and a most interesting exchange coming up at 4:05 today. Julian Epstein, Democratic strategist, and Jack Berkman, who I'm sure many of you recognize from the talk shows, Republican strategist. We're going to have both of them with us coming up right around 4:05. As I say, it seems like nothing ever goes exactly on time here. But we'll work with it. Welcome to the show. Guy James, the Guy James Show, coming to you through the Head On Radio Network. Bob is doing the yeoman's work back in Beckley. He's doing the production today. So we hope all that's coming out just fine. Sounds fine here. We are at the very elegant Mayflower Hotel. Those of you that weren't listening yesterday, beautiful, beautiful place. And several thousand people showed up for this. So it's interesting that so many people come. You know, and the people come to this, they are not politicians. They are the people that go back home and do the yeoman's work for health care, for all these conferences they have in Washington. It serves to energize the grassroots people. We have many healthcare professionals here, the nurses, people work in local clinics, people work in disadvantaged places in Los Angeles and the poorer communities where access to healthcare isn't, just isn't available to a lot of people. So it's important that this sort of people, the grassroots people that come to these, are energized when they go home and know what to do. We're waiting for our first guest to come over right now. I don't know if they've got her lined up or not. Again, I apologize for the delay. How many of you saw that Republican debate last night? I have to be honest. I didn't see all of it. I fell asleep about three quarters of the way through it, and I must say that up until the time that I fell asleep through it, and haven't had a chance to catch up on the rest of it today, forgive me, but I didn't hear health care hardly mentioned at all. I don't know if they mentioned it and talked about it at length after when I went to sleep. I just don't know, but I found it interesting that one of the most important issues of our time was not even mentioned. I found that most interesting. We're going to take a quick break right now while we're waiting for our first guest to drop by while I get myself organized here. And we'll be back in just a moment or two, so don't go away. You're listening to the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Don't touch that mouse. Strictly Confidential is LGBT radio. 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Many colors in the homo rainbow. Don't be afraid to let your color shine. Many colors in the homo rainbow. Show me yours, I'm gonna show you mine.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here are some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interest, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open Caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan Open Caption videos or call 1-800-237-6213.
This is the Head On Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Guy Jim Show here in the Head On Radio Network. Busy place, so we've got several great guests for you today. And one of the more interesting bios that I think I've read in a very, very long time, we have Andrea Batista Schlesinger with us. Andrea, she's the executive director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy. And let me suggest that all of you, if we don't have the information up right away, Google that group and find out everything you can, because it's very, very, very interesting. And I'm afraid I hadn't done my homework on it up until the past day or two. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
First of all, welcome to the conference. I know you've been here, what, yesterday and today?
I just came down today, actually.
Today. Mm-hmm. And are you, you're doing various shows here?
Doing various shows to absorb the overall messages of the conference. And
that's what I want to ask. Why are you here? Why did you attend? It's interesting. We hear so many different stories of people. Why people are here?
Well, the work that we do at the Drum Major Institute as a progressive think tank is it's focused a lot on the squeezed middle class. And you know, you can't have a strong American democracy, a strong economy, if you have no strong middle class. And obviously, healthcare, the theme of today's conference, is a major challenge for today's middle class. I mean, an increasing number of the 47 million Americans who are uninsured are middle class families.
And there may be families. And what do you consider middle class? Up to what income? And I know geographically that varies, but
it does vary a lot. You know, the truth is, in this country, 80% of Americans identify as middle class, so you know, we try to keep the term as all-encompassing as possible. It's almost a state of mind rather than an income. You know, different people do it. To some people, 25% to 100% over poverty. I mean, there are different. That's how the census defines it. There are different ways of measuring it, but we prefer to think about the indicators of what it means to be middle class as we've come to know it in this country: access to higher education, to retirement security, to health care, to being able to take care of elderly parents without having to choose between also putting your kids to college. So we look at the indicators as opposed to a particular income level.
And it's all slipping away, isn't it? And all the things you mentioned, education even, if you don't have enough, you've got health care, terrible doctor bills and so forth to pay, you can't afford to send you. It all knits together eventually.
It does. You know, I always laugh at the way the people who do this professionally think about these issues. You know, there's health care and education. And you know, but the typical middle-class American doesn't wake up and say, today is health care day, and tomorrow will be retirement security day, and Wednesday will be immigration day. I mean, all of these issues relate. And, of course, we need to go deeply, as this conference does, into each of those challenges if we're going to come up with solutions. But we need to understand that these things are challenges because there's a bigger economic picture that is a macro challenge for middle-class families and for people who are trying to work their way into the middle class.
Certainly. I think there are a lot more people dropping out of the middle class that are moving up into it at the moment.
Well, you know, there were exit polls at the end of 2006, which were pretty striking. And I think for the first time, the majority of voters said that they didn't think their kids would do better than them. And that's striking stuff. But, you know, yeah, I mean, when the average cost of for a four-year public college, you know, goes up over 60%, takes office, you know, I mean, that's a public school. so, of course, the what we typically think of as making a middle-class lifestyle are getting harder. I mean, everything from school, of course, but to milk, to gas. I mean, obviously, to healthcare, that's why we're here. All of those costs are skyrocketing while wages are stagnant. And it's not like productivity. It's not like American people aren't working harder. They are. But wages and salaries are the smallest portion of the GDP since they started measuring. That's a problem.
Well, productivity, you know, we love to have politicians. We love to have President Bush, for example, brag about the great productivity of the American worker. The problem is, who benefited from that? The American worker is a whole lot more productive in the last couple of decades, for sure. But the money didn't go, the extra productivity didn't go to the workers.
No, absolutely not. And instead, workers are facing increasing risk, for their own retirement, for their own health care. And that's the kind of economy that we're currently living in. I mean, I'm glad that the president finally last week that things aren't going so well for middle-class families. I mean, the people who are study this every day have known this for quite a while and have been saying it. And, and the president himself expressed shock after 2006. I just don't know why the rosy economic picture isn't getting to people. Well, it's not getting to people because it's not true for people. The pie might be growing, but the slice that goes to, each individual family isn't. And that message has finally gotten through to him.
This latest stimulus package, let's talk about politics for a minute. What do you think of the stimulus package? My wife and I had a chance to go to a Radio Shack today. Well, I don't know if I should say we had a chance. Today. And it was interesting to hear the conversation that was taking place amongst the clerks. They didn't know I was listening, but they were talking about how they were going to spend this fabulous amount of money that's going to this huge windfall that's going to come their way soon. What do you think of that?
Well, it's not a huge windfall, but those clerks need to spend that money because those clerks spending that money keeps
actually,
the stores.
Actually, I said huge with my tongue.
Oh, no. I know. But I understood that. But even if it's $300, that's money that's going into local economies that has to be spent. That's why shops like ours were saying, you can't just do this to people who pay income taxes because there are people who are too poor to qualify to pay federal income tax. But they're the ones who are shopping at the local stores. They're the ones who are actually going to infuse money into this local economy. So you absolutely have to direct the money. I mean, there are some things about the stimulus package that I wish were different. I wish the president would keep talking about making his 01 and 03 tax cuts permanent as if it isn't obvious, what has happened. I wish we didn't have these business incentives that basically reward businesses for decisions they were going to make already and that otherwise have a pretty negligible impact. And that's not coming from someone who's anti-business. I'm the daughter of a small business owner. I have, this is an anti-business. It's just when you're in an impending recession, you have to make choices. That's what public policy is. And if you're going to make choices, go with what you know works. I wish they would instead decide to extend unemployment benefits. A whole lot of people are going to be losing their jobs if this recession comes. If that's true, they're going to need more than 26 weeks if we're going to keep their local economies, the local economies in which they live, going. So I think some of it was good. I think some of it was rhetorically important for the president, but for us, not. And I think it will be a first step, but it won't be the only thing that they need to do.
Well, certainly, and I mentioned earlier on the program, I'm talking to some politicians, frankly, this morning, and talking about if we do get a health care plan, if we do get a new administration, and they take health care seriously, how soon could we actually get something in force? How soon could we get it passed? Getting it passed and getting it implemented are two different things. It could be years, I think, and I think people need to help a lot quicker than many years down the road. But politics being what it is, the government being what it is, I wonder if the middle class can hang on long enough.
Well, I think the middle class is an endangered species at this point. I mean, you see people losing their homes. This is a crisis that I think we won't even fully understand the ramifications of for years to come. It's not a hysteria. I mean, you see it. It's in the data. It's there. And that doesn't mean that there aren't people who worked hard and who have attained a comfortable lifestyle and that those people shouldn't be acknowledged. They should. Absolutely. They worked hard. They did. But the issue is it easy enough? And if it's not easy enough, then what can we do within the realm of public policy to, you know, to facilitate it? So at the same time as we're seeing all of this, and we know that, for example, union workers make more, are more likely to have health insurance, more likely to have retirement security, at the same time, Congress votes no on the Employee Free Choice Act to make it easier to join a union. So, you know, we still vote on a Peru trade deal, even though we know the impact of previous trade deals on our local economy. So it's, you know, the policy is going to have to change if we want the situation to change. And that's not just going to be up to politicians. It's going to be up to us.
The roof has caved in on so many people, people in the middle class. I know a lot of middle. I'm from that group, and you may be as well. The roof has just come caving in. First of all, the people 20, 30 years ago, almost all unionized workers had company-paid health care. They've almost all lost it by now. Pensions are going by the wayside. Benefits that they had, people that did for the first time in the 60s and 70s and 80s could finally afford middle class to send their kids to decent colleges. It's just all gradually being chipped away now where, in my day, we had mom, just dad out working. Now mom and dad are working for the same income or less with far fewer benefits. It's just all crashed in.
Well, and the idea that it's just everybody wants an SUV and a latte is silly. I mean, that you know, the number one and two reasons for bankruptcy are job loss and healthcare crisis. So this isn't because people are trying to keep up a certain status. And, you know, I think I listen to Lou Dobbs sometimes. Listen, you don't have to tell me about Lou Dobbs.
This is not going to be a Lou Dobbs interview for you.
No. I was on his show. Let me tell you.
I know you were.
Thank you. And I think sometimes, like almost up until the immigration stuff, does he make sense? And then I realized, but here's the issue. There's no solutions. But there are solutions. You know, I mean, that's the difference between just talking about these things wildly and irresponsibly and actually trying to make something better. You know, there is an Employee Free Choice Act that Congress could vote into that would make it easier to organize. There are tax reform plans out there. Charlie Rangel is, from my home state, is pushing one that would make our situation more progressive, that would favor middle-class people over big businesses that don't need those tax breaks. There are choices that we can make, but people need to get what's at stake, what policies are actually on the table, and start holding their elected officials accountable for pushing them.
Well, as somebody that does what I do here, I'm especially concerned. You mentioned Lou Dobbs.
Sorry.
I'll add in Limbaugh. I'll add in Hannity. I'll add in Bill O'Reilly. I'll add in a great deal of people on the right. I don't know if I want to call it demagoguery or not, but in such simplistic terms, they're able to talk about this issue of health care, and I'll pull myself up by my bootstraps. I think it's such a simple issue for people. It's like somebody said, well, you know, they use the scare tactics. Well, the Muslims are going to come over and kill you at your house tonight. You know, they're able to do that, and they're doing it with health care. Everything important to the middle class, you've got all this group with Dobbs. They know how to appeal. You brought up an interesting subject when you mentioned Lou Dobbs. But anyway.
Sorry about that. I have a little bit of an obsession with him, but... But, yeah, you know, what I resent the most is that it just doesn't come with solutions. And what that does is it creates for people a sense of inevitability, that the way things are is the way they inevitably are going to be, but it's not so. There are policies on the table. If I can make a little plug, we have a website.
Please.
That we launched a couple months ago, themiddleclass.org. You can go on there and learn about the legislation that Congress has voted on in easily accessible terms, you know, not like a think tank would normally produce. And then you can click and find out how your member of Congress voted on those bills. Some of those bills haven't turned into law. You'll find out why or why not. Are they in the middle class's best interest or not? You can find out there. Until we actually start engaging in a conversation about policy and start monitoring our elected officials and knowing what they're voting on and what they aren't, then, you know, the status quo is our fate. And there are solutions that could make things better. There are things. We could have passed SCHIP. We could have given millions more children health insurance. We decided not to. And people should know whether it was their member of Congress who voted yes or voted no, and they should think about that the next time they go into the voting booth. And people forget, oh, wait, it's not just about the White House. It's about Congress.
We had a discussion not more than an hour ago over dinner with some other folks, and somebody brought it up and specific terms about health care that I don't know why I never thought of it. I wish I had. The Democrats, so many times, I'm a Democrat, so many times people on the left get involved in minutia and people's eyes roll back in their heads as you're trying to explain everything to them. But health care, you know, well, I buy my own health care, I make a good living. My kid goes to school, and I have health care. But the kid, there may be 30 kids in the class, and five of them, statistically speaking, wouldn't have health care in this country. And they come to school with the flu, they come to school with cold. My kid sits next to him, class gets sick, brings it home to me, I have to stay home from work. It's and on and on and on and on. I don't think people understand how far this goes. Well, I'm not going to pay for somebody's health care. You are.
Right. Well, there is a sense that I think the conservative right has really supported, which is that we're all islands unto ourselves and that we are responsible for our own conditions, and that's why we don't need to engage in public policy because, you know, it's really just about us and our effort. And that's a perfect example. But the same thing is true of education. Does it benefit you if the people in your community don't have access to good quality schools? Does it really benefit you if there's a huge population of undocumented people who are on the roads without license, without knowing how to drive, who are bringing down most likely the wages in your industry because they're easily exploited? Does that really benefit you? I mean, there are so many questions in which if we just conceived of our interests more broadly, you'd wind up with a constituency of people who support progressive policy. But, you know, and that's why a tank like ours, you know, we're interested in shaping those debates, not just doing the direct policy advocacy, but trying to link these issues and make it clear for people.
Take a moment and tell us all about your organization, please.
Well, we were founded during the Civil Rights Movement. That's where the name comes from, a theme of Dr. King's. He would talk about the drum major instinct, that instinct to lead. It could be used for good, it could be used for bad, he said, but that instinct to lead larger movements. And we were founded by a group of associates of his, who he would refer to as his think tank. They would help do legislative strategy, outreach, fundraising, and went into a long period of inoperation after King was killed, but were revived recently really to take on these think tanks of the right who have shaped such important conversations, who have made government the enemy, who have positioned taxes as the fuel for that enemy, and, you know, and to really take them on these issues, and at the same time to try to give those on the front lines, elected officials, organizers, activists like you who want to have informed conversations, to give them the tools that would help advance conversations about social and economic justice.
Very good. Well, it's a great organization, and like I said, everybody needs to... By the way, do look up this website, themiddleclass.org. I haven't seen that yet, and I'm looking
Check
forward
it
to it. Andrea, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. We appreciate it very much. Thanks for being here at this conference. There's so many people like you here that are so important to move out into the countryside and get things done for people instead of just having to depend on politicians all the time.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much. We'll take a quick break now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. And you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
Great universities never set out simply to reflect the communities in which they exist. Rather, they serve as seedbeds of change in an ever-changing world. They take pride in being places where truth is freely sought, where inquiry is encouraged, where new ideas and new ways can develop and flourish at the expense of the old. When a true academic community, instructors and students together, acts and expresses itself freely, without fear, all of society benefits. Concord University is already using this new set of challenges as opportunities to serve in ways that strengthen its dedication to community, its commitment to service. in graduate education, in professional services to working professionals, in highly respected fields of study where standards remain high, in continuing to place graduates in the very best professional and graduate schools in the nation. Concord University remains the very best higher education bargain in this region. Don't ever allow yourself to accept anything less. Concord University, still since 1872, an education you can put to work. For an appointment, call 1-800-344-6679.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can grab off our website over at progressive.org. Let me tell you why I hate Harry Reid. For one thing, he's repeatedly let funding bills for the Iraq War sail right through. But more cowardly even than that is Harry Reid's unforgivable role in the current Bush effort to reform FISA. Reid and Reid alone made the decision to bring to the floor of the Senate the disastrous bill of the Intelligence Committee rather than the far better bill that the Judiciary Committee had carefully hashed out. The Judiciary bill did not give retroactive immunity to the telecom companies. The Intelligence bill does. The Judiciary bill did not allow the NSA to scoop up every single international communication into and out of the United States. The Intelligence bill does. The Judiciary bill did not allow the NSA to speciously wiretap someone overseas without a warrant so as to get at a U.S. citizen here at home. But the Intelligence bill does. The Judiciary bill did not weaken the oversight of the FISA court. The Intelligence bill does. When he chose to have the Senate debate the Intelligence bill, Reid knew full well just how hard it would be to get a majority to agree to replace it or amend it. This horrible bill now has Harry Reid's name all over it. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If you can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune into Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texan's liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
And if you want another kind of love, I'll wear a mask for you. If you want a partner, open my hand. If you want to strike me down in anger, here I stand. If I'm your man.
Don't miss Rick's Place with Rick Goodner. Part of the weekend lineup on The Horn, running all weekend in rotation with The Showers Report and Night Sounds.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
All right, we're back. Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you all along with us this afternoon. Thanks for being with us. Here we are at the Health America 2000 conference. Chaos here, I must say. People, when the sessions change, people in and out of the strategy sessions and all, we've got lots of people out here in this beautiful grand promenade, I guess you would call it. If any of you have ever been to the Mayflower, you'd understand what an exquisite facility this is. Right now, I want to welcome a gentleman from the Small Business Majority, a new political voice, John Arzenmeyer. John, have I came too bad?
Close. Good enough.
Welcome to the program. Why are you here at the conference?
We're here because we represent small business owners who feel that we absolutely need to have comprehensive health care reform. The system's broken. Premiums are going up for small business at, you know, incredible rates, so 125% in the last year. Most businesses can't afford to cover their employees. Of 10 businesses or less, only 40% of businesses cover their employees. And it's an arbitrary and capricious system, and people are making decisions about whether to actually start businesses or grow businesses based on healthcare instead of making decisions based on what, you know, on business reality. So we don't think that the traditional small business organizations have adequately represented the needs of small business in this area. We've done a lot of research of small business attitudes, and small business people are really looking for government to work in partnership with them and with individuals to solve this problem.
You mentioned 40% of small business have
The number is about it's about 55% of businesses that have 100 employees or less that actually provide coverage to their employees. But at businesses of 10 employees or less, which is the majority of businesses, only 40% of those businesses provide coverage to their employees.
How extensive a coverage are we talking about?
Well, and it's mixed, and of course, you know, within the 40%, you have, you know, some that's not, you know, 100% as well. So, in fact, not only are you seeing fewer and fewer businesses covered, but you're seeing deductibles go up, you're seeing copays go up. So, essentially, you know, coverage overall is getting a lot worse, and the costs are going up. There was an article in Business Week last week that talked about the premise of the article was, gee, there's competition in the small business market, and they said, gee, what happened is this company that thought they were going to get a 40% increase only got a 17% increase, and it cost them more. And this, the article portrayed this as a good thing, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, what kind of a crazy system do we have is that when you get a 17% annual increase and your benefit, you know, what you're getting goes down, that's considered a victory.
Well, I live in Florida, and that kind of sounds like the homeowner's insurance deal we're going through right now. Same kind of figures. They actually use figures like that. My heart is with small business. I'm a former small businessman myself, and for a good many years, and I know how hard it is to struggle if you've got 40 or 50 employees and trying to make a living and scrape by, and you're working against the giants in the business anyway. Just trying to stay in business is tough enough, let alone to provide comprehensive health care for employees. Just provide health care for key employees, not everybody. What about Romney's solution in Massachusetts? You know, he often brags about how small business likes the program in Massachusetts and all that. What do you think is the solution here? We know what the problems are.
Well, the Massachusetts program, which by the way, Romney's, you know, has failed to advocate that on a national level. But having said that, he does deserve some credit for it passing. It's far from a perfect solution, but I do have to give Massachusetts credit. They were the first out of the box. We're based in California. We've done most of our work in California. And which has, as most people know, a very comprehensive solution that's being debated right now. We would not be there if it hadn't been for Massachusetts. So a lot of the state-based solutions that you now see being proposed, which are being done in the absence of any federal solution, owe a debt of gratitude to Massachusetts for going first. You know, Massachusetts obviously deserves credit for understanding this needs to be a solution where everyone comes together in shared responsibility, where, you know, it's a bipartisan solution, and for saying, you know, the goal is we've got to get everybody covered here. Now, were all the details perfect? No, it was a first attempt, and I think, you know, we can all learn from what they're going through, and we can sort of see now how it's playing out. So in concept, we think it's a great idea what they did. Do we think it's the perfect solution? No. We think there are ways to improve on it.
Small business, how are they affected by it's mandated in Massachusetts, right?
It is mandated. There's a very low mandate. It's $295 a year if you don't provide insurance. That's something like $15 a month. So it's or $25 or whatever. It's a very small amount of money. So. You know, yes, it is, but you know, to be honest with you, the research we've done shows that small business will support, you know, a higher level of mandate than that. And I think the key is that businesses are looking for this to be fair. They're looking for it to be affordable. I mean, right now in California, to cover your employee, it's 11% of payroll on average to buy insurance for your employees. So any system that allows you to pay in for less than that, in the California system it's anywhere from 1% to 6.5% based on how the proposal is out there, based on what you how much revenues you have, that's going to be already a step in the right direction. That enables your employees to buy in, you know, through a subsidized system at that point. So, you know, there's no one solution that fits all. The key is that it's got to be a solution where everyone's participating, where we're treated fairly, where it's affordable for everyone. You can have some, you know, cost differences based on, you know, perhaps age of employee. You've got to eliminate this notion of raising the rates based on people's health. You've got to have a system that's predictable for individuals and for businesses. And so, you know, we found in the research we did that if you accomplish all of this, you will get a majority of small business people to support the solution.
How many different states are working on a similar plan right now?
Well, there are probably six or seven states now that have, you know, serious proposals. And I'm not going to name them all here, but Washington, New Mexico, Oregon, Colorado, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, to name some of them that are actively working on solutions right now. We're expanding the effort. The organization we formed last year was actually Small Business for Affordable Healthcare, and we've now partnered with the Herndon Alliance, and we're launching that nationally. And what that means is we're going to be empowering and working with and helping to get funding for state small business groups to in about 6 to 10 states. And then we're going to start to make contact with small business owners in all 50 states, and then slowly over time try to empower more and more states to take an active role in organizing small business people. But the ultimate goal is to have, not only are we empowering the states and are we getting benefits of synergies across states and providing them with tools and tips on how they can better message, better organize, is ultimately to have an umbrella organization that we would represent that would be a national small business organization that could go toe-to-toe with other small business organizations that might not support national health care reform when the time comes for this to be debated on the national level.
When the time comes. That was my next question. You're working on this on a state-by-state basis, and I guess the question is, do you think it can be solved on a state-by-state basis without getting the feds involved?
Long term, I don't see a solution that isn't a national solution, but there is a lot that states can do on their own. And quite frankly, if you're a legislator or a governor in a state and nothing's happening on the national level, you're sort of obligated to say, well, what can we do on the state level? You do, rather than sit around and just throw up your hands. Also, if you look at most social movements in this country, there was often movement at the state level before it got to the federal level. So there is precedent for this happening on the state level. So not only will these efforts help people in these states, but it will help, I think, to get the federal government, get our federal legislators and the president, hopefully, off the dime to figure out how to solve this. And the more the states do, the more pressure, I think, will be put on the federal government to take action.
All right. My question is, if we do this on a state-by-state basis and we get all the states working on this one by one until the umbrella group is more viable in the future, if you get a state like Massachusetts or you get something finally started that's workable in California, do you think that the states, especially the ones that get it right, and eventually somebody will get it just right, do you think they will just serve as an example for the feds to use it broad-based across the country, or will you face resistance from the people in those states that are getting it right? I don't know if you'd hear any resistance from anybody in Massachusetts right now, but let's say California gets this program going and it's working really well for small business. Will the people of California, will the small businessmen in California resist a national movement then?
Well, I think any national solution is going to have to, you know, how that interacts with what a state has is going to have to be taken into account. And it's going to need to be worked out. In other words, if you have an obligation of businesses to pay on a state level and then there's a national plan, you're obviously going to have to work out some credits with that. I mean, we even have a situation in California where the city of San Francisco has passed a comprehensive universal health care. It's a little different because it's only, you know, it's facilities in San Francisco based for people who live in San Francisco. But the fact of the matter is there's a business obligation. It's been the subject of a lawsuit. But assuming that this stays in place, even when the California legislation is going to have to be some accommodation for businesses that are paying into the San Francisco system, and then all of a sudden there's a state obligation. So, yeah, the various levels of government need to work out how that all works together. But at the end of the day, that's going to be a lot easier than getting these things passed in the first place.
That's San Francisco, really the exception, isn't it? Am I correct in saying everybody that lives within the city limits of San Francisco must be covered in some fashion?
Yes.
Everybody?
Yes.
That's it. How are they doing?
Coverage is through. It's not like you can just go to any doctor. The coverage, if you want to, I mean, you can if you want, but if you want to get the coverage that's being provided for you, you've got to use the facilities in San Francisco. So it's kind of utilizing the public San Francisco facilities that the hospital
has. How's it working?
Well, it hasn't really gone off the ground yet, and there's been a lawsuit, and the lower court struck it down, and then the appeals court reinstated it. So they've gotten a couple pilots going in a couple of neighborhoods, but we don't have enough data. It hasn't taken off across the city yet, but it will be.
Do you think it's a model for other?
I think it is a good faith, serious, pragmatic effort to deal with the problem, and I'm hopeful that it will work. I think there are many serious, pragmatic ways to deal with it. We're not ideologically tied to any one solution. I think logical statements, whether they come from the left or from the right, about how to solve this problem doesn't get us anywhere. We need to sit down and look at this pragmatically, and San Francisco has come up with a very pragmatic way to deal with the problem. You know, I think we need to see, just like in Massachusetts, we need to see how it works and we need to learn from it. But I think, you know, it's got a good chance of, almost any of these solutions have a good chance of being better than the status quo.
I was troubled by the fact that I watched a national debate last night, a political party have a debate, and this subject got the short shrift. It was barely mentioned in healthcare, and it's an enormous problem in this country. Barely mentioned last night.
Well, when it is mentioned by the particular party you're talking about, it tends to be a lot of sloganeering, a lot of ideology that is thrown about, you know, socialized medicine, taxes. These are not constructive ways. It's a problem, and again, I don't want to single out the, you know, that party or the right or whatever. I mean, I think, you know, you have this problem, you know, everywhere. Where
just
people,
so you know,
get,
I do single them out.
Okay,
so.
Well, we're officially a nonpartisan organization, and,
yeah.
And we know that, by the way, there needs to be a bipartisan solution. So we don't expect that there's going to be a solution in states or at the national level without Republicans of good faith coming on board as well. And so, you know, we want to keep that in mind here. But, you know, look, they don't have as comprehensive plans as the Democrats have. McCain has a pretty comprehensive cost containment plan. He deserves credit for putting that forward. He doesn't have a comprehensive sort of access plan. The Democrats have really made an effort to have comprehensive access and cost containment plans. They're pretty similar. There's some minor differences that people have picked apart, but that's really not important. And that's, you know, a step in the right direction to say, you know, even if we all know when whoever gets elected, whatever's put forth or whatever's decided, it's not going to look exactly like what was in their campaign proposal, but at least it's saying, hey, this is a comprehensive problem that needs to be solved comprehensively, needs to be solved by bringing everybody together, and, you know, this is one way to do it. There's no one right or wrong way. As long as it's covering everybody, it's ensuring quality, It's dealing with prevention, it's dealing with cost containment, then there's multiple ways to deal with it. And we're open to, you know, rally our members behind any solution that satisfies those principles and is likely of moving forward.
Well, I guess the big question is, can we get anything done bipartisan these days with the terribly poisonous atmosphere in this town and many places around country? It remains to be seen if we can get both parties to wake up and, as they say, smell the coffee and understand that we've got to put that aside and start doing something to work together for the good of everybody. Stubbornness, ideology, someone's got to be put aside sooner or later, and I don't know when that's going to happen. It doesn't look very encouraging to me right now, but I certainly would be in favor of it. What's your next step for your organization? Are you trying to do as many states as possible?
Essentially, yes. I mean, I think, you know, the state, we're going to continue the work in California and expand that, and we're going to the goal is to be sort of intensively in 6 to 10 states by the end of the year, and to have made contact with small business owners or perhaps organizations that have some connection to this in all the other states as well. And then to go from there to add more states and empower them and help figure out how that's going to be financed, et cetera. At some point, obviously, the if there is a national debate all of a sudden, if there's a possibility of legislation at the national level, we will turn our attention away from, not away from, but we'll add to the state efforts by layering on top, you know, an effort at the national level to sort of bring all the groups and members together that we have state by state.
What about politics in California? Governor Schwarzenegger, he's a fairly progressive Republican. Have you worked with him or any people in his organization?
Yeah, he's got a great team. As does the Democratic leadership. They all have really. I've really been impressed with the quality of staff, the quality of teams that they have working on this. And by the way, all the activist groups, the community groups, they're just solid, knowledgeable people, really committed to solving this problem. And you know, Schwarzenegger's team's been great to work with. And we said we should move forward with this compromise. We didn't overtly endorse any of the we didn't endorse his versus the legislators. We sort of encouraged them to come together. Now that they've come together, we want to see this move forward. But he's been all along the way, and he has a great team of people, and he's been committed to this.
Is this something that can tend to be strictly geographic? I mean, California, you know how the rest of the country looks at California, the left coast and all that. If you find a workable solution in California, geographically, is it something that necessarily fits other states as well? Because California...
I don't think there's any one size fits all, but I think there are going to be some common themes, like the theme of shared responsibility, the theme of non-discrimination, of some sort of community rating system that doesn't, that maybe there's a ban for age but not for health status. And I think there's going to see some common themes throughout, basically affordability and but there are probably a variety of different ways this can work, and I think each state needs to figure out what is going to work for them. For the states have slightly different populations, they have different political environments. Maybe some are going to be able to do more than others. So, we think that for the most part, anything is better than the status quo, and we think that if what's working, if there's another solution in another state, that's fine.
Well, I would love to see it work in California. California is always, as many people, and it is a progressive state, and it's a state that has been willing to jump in the water ahead of other people when not knowing if it's cold or not. We've seen that time after time, and maybe they'll set a precedent for everybody else in the country. I sure hope so. With the population of that state, that'd be a huge step forward, and I think it would make governments of other states certainly take up and take notice. You have to notice what California is doing. You have to.
Well, we hope so.
John, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. It's been a pleasure having you. Wish you much success, and I'm sure you go back from this great conference energized, meet a lot of great people here that, I don't know, I've met a lot of people here getting some real energy to go out and redouble their efforts, and no matter what the area of the healthcare they seem to be working in. And I want to thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
John Eisenmeyer. He is the founder and CEO of Small Business Majority. It's a new political voice. You can see his website at smallbusinessmajority.org, smallbusinessmajority.org. Be sure and go over and visit that. In your state, you can contact these folks. Things need to be started, and everybody has to start somewhere. We're going to take a quick break now. You're listening to The Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is the Head On Radio Network.
Now I lay me down to sleep.
I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake.
Across Appalachia, children pray at night. Coal companies are destroying Appalachia with 3 million pounds of high explosives per day. Take a stand. Go to crmw.net. Coal River Mountain Watch. Be part of the solution so you and they can sleep at night. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net.
The trains are rolling by and I can feel the ground rumbling.
As I understand the conflict right now between the president's bill and the one supported by the Democrats, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, is that John McCain and Lindsey Graham and the Democrats say that the bill, the standards we use, should be the standards that are the same as the treaty we signed, the Geneva Convention signed after World War II that every civilized nation follows. And the president is saying, that restricts me too much. That's too humane. I want to be able to do other things. I won't say what they are, but sources tell us that things like waterboarding, you know, drowning people, putting them in 50-degree weather. And the question, I think, is should we hold the United States to the same standards that England holds itself to, that Canada holds itself to, that other civilized nations hold themselves to?
Get the view from inside the Beltway with Mark Levine on the Radio Inside Scoop. Right here, 2 to 3 p.m. weekdays on the Head On Radio Network.
This is the story about a group of kids who volunteered.
We fixed stuff. Did some art projects with the kids.
Cleaned up the park.
We worked in the woods.
I just wanted to do something.
We fixed up his house.
Did something for the planet.
Hey, that was all I needed. And you know what? It was great.
It was a blast.
At first, they didn't know each other.
I didn't know anyone.
Well, that didn't last long.
This guy is really funny.
Me?
These are my new friends. These are really good new friends.
Are you into it?
Are You Into It is a volunteer program for kids like you who care. If you want to make a difference in your community and make friends, call 4-H toll-free at 1-888-77-YOUTH or check out our website at www.areyouintoit.com.
This definitely made a difference.
I feel like I can do everything now.
Yeah!
A public service message brought to you by 4-H, the Cooperative Extension System, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
Time for the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. at the beautiful Mayflower Hotel. We're be gone to news in just a moment or two, and then right after that, we've got one of the more interesting interviews I think you're going to hear in a while coming up. Coming up at 4:05, we've got Julian Epstein and Jack Berkman, and as you know, I don't have to tell any of you, I'm sure, that they have polar opposite views on many things, so that that'd be interesting indeed. A tremendous turnout for this conference this year. We were here last year, and it's growing and growing every year, and as you heard the director say yesterday, it just gets bigger and bigger all the time, and everybody, you know, when we've heard such a diversity of people, different views on healthcare, what to do about it, whether it's single payer, whether it's, you know, it's just been all over the place. So we don't know for sure. It's going to be interesting to see how that works out. Anyway, we're going to pause for news coming up at the top of the hour. We'll turn it back to Bob, and right after the news is over, we'll be back with you. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network.
Talk, and lately a bit of action after dark. Behind the big
got Merlin, they're knocking, the colonel standing in the sun, with his stupid face, the glasses, and the gun. I know what happened, I read the book, I believe I just got to the
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Ford and the UAW drove another nail into the coffin of good middle-class U.S. auto jobs Thursday with the announcement of a negotiated buyout offer going to all 54,000 UAW Ford workers. Ford is offering the one-time cash lump sums to get rid of well-paid auto workers so they can be replaced with workers earning half their wages. Ford says it lost $2.7 billion in 2007. That's an improvement over the previous year. The Ford buyout offer comes on top of GM's similar new buyouts this year, part of a strategic plan by the U.S. automakers to destroy good wages and benefits won through decades of struggle by the UAW rank and file. Similar buyouts were offered in 2007. The U.S. House has a deal with the White House on an economic stimulus package aimed at trying to ease the effects of a recession. If you're poor but earned at least $3,000 in 2007, you'll get a $300 check. Workers who made $75,000 or less will get a $600 check. Married couples who earned $150,000 or less will get $1,200 under this plan. The Senate, though, will have to agree before those checks are in the mail. The House version of this stimulus does not extend unemployment benefits, and it does not increase food stamp allotments. With fewer demands on the table, the writer's strike is closer to an end. Jesse Russell reports.
Writers are itching to get back to work in Hollywood, but they aren't quite there yet. In order to move discussions forward, the Writers Guild of America has removed from the bargaining table demands to be allowed to organize reality and animation writers. The guild has argued that they should be able to represent the reality show writers because, while they're called reality shows, the writers essentially have to take hours upon hours of footage and weave a linear storyline. Still on the table is the core of the strike action, demands for residuals from work appearing on new media. The Directors Guild of America is currently set to vote on a contract that they reached with the producers that would allow for 2% of revenue from work that appears online. If the writers and producers can come to an agreement similar to the Directors Guild, then it could save the Academy Awards, which are scheduled to air on February 24th.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says he's disappointed by a U.S. Court of Appeals refusal to enforce its decision striking down a Bush Transportation Department rule extending truckers on the road hours from 10 to 11 hours. The Teamsters say allowing Bush to extend the hours truckers are allowed to be behind the wheel each day is a traffic safety hazard. Here's today's economic report. Median home prices fell 1.8% in 2007 for the first annual decline in four decades. Home sales were down 13%, the biggest drop in 25 years. With the housing crisis wiping out untold billions in wealth, now comes news that Wall Street and bankers are nervous about a potential new crisis, a bond insurance crisis. Two large companies, AmBac and MBIA, insuring bonds worth more than $1 trillion, are struggling. And if they fail, pension funds and banks could see billions of dollars in losses. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
That's right. Democratic talk show. Not progressive. Not that weenie talk. Democratic liberal. Okay? That's me. I don't use that word progressive. And I've I frankly, I've got a good progressive guy with me, a Democrat with me, and I've got a scoundrel over at the other microphone.
And they don't even give me a headset.
No headset. We're sorry. We didn't figure you deserved one. We have Jack Berkman with us right now, as you well know, all of you that watched TV and take account of politics. You're going to see Jack all over the place. He's been on, God knows, all the shows on TV. You've seen him probably far too many times, most of you. And we also have Julian Epstein, and I know all of you know Julian. He's been a Democratic strategist and activist for a long, long time. And I thank both of you for coming on the program today. As I was talking to the guys before, while we were at the news break, I had to mention that it was not unusual at all for me. I mean, walking down the halls today, we had Tom Daschle and Governor Warner, and I mean, just all, Pelosi was here yesterday, and all the politicians have been here, John Conyers and all, and nobody takes a second look. They see everybody walking down the aisle here, and it's just like, oh, you know, ho-hum, we're at a group, we're in Washington after all. But then I see Jack Berkman walking through here, and it's like almost, and you know, this is not necessarily a political event, but we'll talk.
Well, Guy, we're here to stop the train. We have to stop this train before it gets out of control in this country. That's why I'm here.
God forbid we insure everybody.
So you want to
the train? You don't want to be.
Yeah, it would be a terrible thing if people had health care, Jack.
Well, it wouldn't be a terrible thing. I think it would be a great thing if it happened naturally through a market economy, but I don't want to see the government come in and socialize 20% of the economy to provide this universal health insurance. That's not something I want to see. Sure, I'd like to see everybody insured. Sure, I'd like to see the market move toward that. I wish we could live in a world of idyllic bliss where everybody had everything and there was no poverty or problems or war or anything like that, but we just don't. And I think some of our friends on the left have trouble accepting reality.
So the long and short of it is, Jack, you just don't want to pay for anybody else's health care in any way, shape, or form, right?
Well, it's not that I don't want to pay for it.
You don't want to chip in.
It's not that I don't want to chip in. I think the society, I think we have to preserve a market economy. I want to see a free enterprise system. I think we have to distinguish between poverty problems and health care problems. I think if you have, you know, we've had this discussion all day long, if you have this mythical family of four or earning $30,000 or whatever that can't pay an $800 a month health insurance premium bill, I think what you have is a poverty problem, and you don't tear down a good health care system to fix that. But, of course, what Hillary wants to do, what they really want to do, the whole discussion of health insurance is a little bit of a ruse for a much broader agenda, which is to socialize the whole health system in the United States.
That name terrifies him, doesn't it, Julian?
Right.
Doesn't it just terrify him?
Well, it's like I said just a minute ago. It's, you know, Franklin Roosevelt had this saying that you have nothing to fear but fear itself. The Republicans offer but fear itself. The fact of the matter is that the free market with respect to health care has really failed for a whole host of reasons. There are lots of anti-competitive practices within the insurance industry. The amount of waste inside the insurance industry is far bigger than it is in, say, the Medicare and Medicaid system. You have over $100 billion each year spent on underwriting and marketing, which is basically tactics the insurance industry uses to avoid paying people they think might become sick one day. We have a wonderful healthcare system in terms of the technology and the expertise of the system. The fact of the matter is more than any country in the world for healthcare, but we insure fewer of our people. More than one in three Americans under the age of 65 is either uninsured or underinsured. The fact of the matter is, what the Democrats are proposing is nothing close to socialized medicine. The reason that Jack uses that word socialized is because he thinks that that will, you know, push people's buttons. Socialized medicine means that the government comes in and takes over the delivery of health care, that the doctors are basically paid and the physicians are paid by the government. Nobody is proposing that. What the Democrats are proposing is to make the private sector work more efficiently by what? Containing costs, for beginning. How do you contain costs? You use the collective bargaining power that the government has through the Medicaid and the Medicare system and through the expansion of those systems that both Edwards and Hillary Clinton proposes to be able to bargain for better rates with, to be able to bargain for better rates with the insurance company. So you have cost control measures. You have subsidies for people that can't afford to pay. Jack talks about a family of four making $30,000, $40,000. Their average premium every year is going to be $14,000. Now, you tell me by the time they get finished paying their rent, or their mortgage, which is in which all housing prices are imploding. By the time they finish paying for their kids for school, you're going to tell me a family of four making $40,000 with a disposable income of maybe $20,000?
Okay, let me throw this out.
The ability to pay $14,000 a year in health care costs?
Let me respond. Let me throw this out. You know what we should do then? Here's an interesting guy. Maybe your radio show could do this. Let's take a deeper look at all this. Let's find these mythical families in the income strata he wants to look for. You know what I'd like to do with that same family? I would like to look at its other spending habits. Did that same family go out and buy on a credit card a $4,500 big screen television off at $27 a month?
Jack, you're not going to use the TV argument.
Well, I sure am.
You're not going to use that.
You could make the same argument. Julian can come in here, change the pronouns, and make the same case against Best Buy and say that these people are bad because of the high-priced televisions.
Simply take the money out of the system that the insurance companies waste trying to figure out who they are not going to insure because they think they might get sick. You can insure every under and underinsured person in this country. People talking about change. Republicans offer nothing about change when it comes to the economy. They want to give us the same tax cuts while spending like drunken sailors programs that have given us incredible deficits in an economy that is not working for most people. They want to give us the same crap in the next election. They want to do nothing in terms of changing the health care crisis. In fact, it's not just Democrats and progressives and liberals who are talking about health care reform. It's the Business Roundtable. If you go up the street three blocks and go see the Business Roundtable, they'll tell you their biggest priority is health care reform because the employer-based system is creating just uncontrollable costs for medium-sized and small businesses.
Here's
the only people that can afford to do it are the GMs of the world, and even GMs now saying the employer-based system is just not working.
But again,
you have to control costs.
Well,
Republicans are offering nothing
GM
in terms of cost
GM
control.
Is the economic equivalent of a desperate man drowning looking for a rope and it can be found anywhere it can find it. So I'm really not concerned about how GM is
great
weighing into
this. Republicans.
Hey, honestly, Jack, no one's concerned about American jobs and GM or Ford.
Right. Or health care.
Here's what Julian is saying. He's saying that there are inefficiencies in the health care system, which is true. There are inefficiencies in everything. And the only way to fix these gross inefficiencies, as he sees them in the marketplace, is to bring in Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam needs to save us from market inefficiency and can save us money if we only create another building done on 7th Street and have that building administer the health system for us. That's what he's saying.
Not administering the health. What is wrong with the notion that the government plays a constructive partnership with the private sector to control costs, to get people who are underinsured or underinsured, to get them insurance, and to start capping costs? We know in the Medicaid and Medicare system that the inefficiencies are far less than they are in the private system. What is your principle?
I used to go out with a gal in Canada whose mother was in Parliament up there. I almost married her, but she couldn't stand. She just couldn't stand my conservative stuff. But I used to sit there. I used to sit there at these bars. In Toronto having these lychee martinis with them. And they would give these speeches like Julian's giving, and I'd listen to all this. And when any member of their family had a health issue, when there was even the slightest that he had a hangnail, for God's sakes, the first thing they did was get on the shuttle and go to Boston. I never knew a one of them who got any kind of health treatment in Toronto going back
Jack,
three
I
generations.
Jack, I got to tell you, I live amongst a tremendous number of Canadians. I live in South Florida. Snowbirds by the God knows how many come down there for winter. And they're only allowed to be in Florida for a certain amount of time before they have to go. And let me tell you, by God, when that day is up, they're on that plane back home to Canada, driving back home to Canada, because they love their health care system. I've talked to that over. Yes, you're going to find, as you said, nothing is perfect, but they love their health care.
90% of Canadians want to keep their health care system. 70% of Americans want to change their health care system. But this is a red herring, which Republicans, when I made the comment that they've got nothing to offer but fear itself, this is the kind of red herring Republicans put out there, because nobody's talking about a Canadian-style system. A Canadian-style system is a single-payer system where the government does, in fact, take over the health care system, not just the payment part of it, but the actual delivery. Nobody's talking about government intervention here with respect to delivery.
What it is
what we're talking
knows.
About, one at a time, what we're talking about here is the government getting in and becoming a constructive partner in the financing part of it, which means subsidies for people that can't afford it, taking the waste out of the system that the insurance companies promote, over $100 billion a year, as I discussed, and being able to set up more competition in the insurance industry so the government can use the collective buying power that it does with pharmaceuticals, for example, with the new legislation that's been passed, to be able to control costs. These are sensible things. These are, in fact, making, this isn't taking over the free market. This is making the free market work more efficiently while trying to take care of a problem where that we are distinguished internationally for being the only country that can't provide health care to all its citizens.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, so he says that. Now, we're talking about insuring the uninsured. My question is, how far beyond that does your candidate want to go? Has she renounced the 93 proposal? Do you want to go into price control?
This is nothing close to the 93 proposal.
Can you say now that your candidate will not enter into the business of any price controls related to pharmaceutical companies?
Never had any discussion, never anything about price controls with respect to the delivery of healthcare.
She did in 93.
We're not talking about 93. We're talking about 2008. And in 93, it wasn't price controls on the pharmaceutical industry. It was the same thing I was talking about, which is using the collective power, bargaining power of the government to be able to get lower prices from the pharmaceutical industry. Nobody's talking about price controls, Jack. These are red Republicans throw out there as a way of keeping the status quo. They will get the message next election. The public does not want the status quo. Even people out there who I think are just phonies, like Mitt Romney, who the only thing he knows about change is how many times has he changed his position last 24 hours. All they're doing is talking about change. But it's these abstract throwaway phrases that the Republicans are using, change, 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 change. But they don't want to do anything about change. They don't want to change the economic policies that are leaving most people out in the cold. They don't want to change the health care policies, which are an embarrassment to this country, the richest, most powerful country in the world, that can't do what small countries can do.
You have to forgive me, but I don't see a country with too many people out in the cold. I see a country where people are buying $4 and $5 Starbucks by the millions.
You're a Republican and you hang out with a wine and cheese martini sipping crowd. One in three Americans under 65 is under or uninsured. That's being left out in the cold. If you're not aware of that, you're not in touch.
Well, how about this? Can we do a study? Why don't we do a study? Guy, do you agree with me that we ought to do these uninsured? First of all, those numbers. Can we look at these people and see what other spending habits they have and then try to determine if this quote-unquote problem is a national health problem or is it a poverty problem? Because that's the relevant policy question, and I don't think anybody tries to tackle it.
So you don't think we have a health care crisis?
I do not, no.
You don't?
Nothing that the market can't fix. I mean, I'm not opposed to a president of the United States getting involved, encouraging companies to move in a direction. I'm not involved with the president of the United States sitting down with Aetna and Blue Cross and saying, look, guys, I think it would be a good thing if you can find a way to solve some of these social problems at the market level. Sure.
That would be the same thing as a certain Republican president we've had sitting down with the oil companies and the Saudis saying, how about helping us out with the oil problem or the gas price? You really believe that the guy, the CEOs of the insurance companies or the pharmaceuticals are going to sit down and listen to that?
Well, sure. Sure, everybody's
sitting down. What incentive would they have for listening to
that? Well, look, I think you bring up oil. Bush has done, the president has done a good job with oil. If it weren't for his leadership in the Mideast, if it weren't for his skillful diplomacy in the Gulf, price of oil would be much worse.
Good job. It's gone from $50 a barrel
now you're doing
$1.20 a barrel.
But, well, you have to understand something. The price of gas, you still see $3.50 a gallon. At $100 a barrel, correlates to the price of about $5 a gallon. It's only because of Bush's work with the Gulf countries and Bush's work with the oil companies here that the price of gas has not moved in sync with the price of a barrel of oil. The president has done that. He hasn't gotten credit for it, though, I think.
So he stopped a little bit of gouging. The fact of the matter is the president has utterly failed in the Mideast, not just with respect to a diplomatic and political solution in Iraq, but in terms of being able to generate influence on important economic issues. Just look at how the neocons have totally screwed up the situation with Russia. Russia is easily a country that could have been on our side on a whole host of issues. What you see now is an alliance between Russia and Iran, not just on the nuclear issue.
That's an old alliance.
Not an old alliance. It's a new alliance in the last two or three. What are you talking about?
Let me tell you something.
It's a new alliance. They've been selling them enriched uranium within the last two or three years. The agreement on oil with the Iranians is something within the last couple of years. What are you talking about? They have utterly screwed up the situation with being able
to contain
our dependency on foreign oil.
The Mideast policy a failure. We were talking about real estate before the show. Do you know what's going on in Baghdad right now? The real estate market in Baghdad is going crazy. The Europeans are in there buying. There are even Americans. The French are in buying real estate in Baghdad like crazy. Do you know what's going on in Basra? Do you know that the real estate market in Basra is reaching a bubble? Can you believe that? And people say you would never hear that on any of the evening news broadcasts. There is a real estate bubble in Basra, and people, but you don't hear these kinds of things. Baghdad is a frenzy real estate market.
I haven't heard that.
Frenzy. But there's no credit to Bush. Imagine that. Imagine, look what we've brought there. People living in darkness under tyranny, being brutalized. And we have brought them a real estate market.
Jack, I've
it's true.
That is comedy.
Jack, I would love it if just one time, you would maybe break some ground on the show. Is there anything? Is there anything that that Mr. Bush has done that, you know, somebody asked me the other day, says, is there anything
that I don't like
that you'll give Bush credit for? And I said, yeah, he's a good dresser. He wears nice. Is there anything that the guy has done that
I don't
agree
like?
With? Yeah.
Oh, sure, education. I don't agree with the president. I don't agree with federalized education. Way too, and I've told him that it's way too much involvement at the federal level. The most conservatives in Congress didn't, but they wanted to support the president. I understand that. I don't support...
Wanted to help those damn kids. Again.
Well, there was just too much. But I think there's ways you can help. Federal government can encourage states. I think education should be a local matter in the United States, and I think Bush has brought it much too much to Washington.
Well, President Bush is too liberal for Jack.
Yeah.
Well, he's more liberal than I am.
that leaves me pretty much speechless. I don't know if there's any hope for you or not.
Great guy. You know, I wish more. I'll tell you this. Anybody who meets the president would vote for him. Anybody he touches will support him. He's a great guy. He's one of the best people I've ever met in politics.
Well, he probably hasn't met 80% of the American people, because this is a guy whose numbers are further in the tank than any modern-day president. This guy, I think, will go down as the worst president in our history.
That's not true.
He is the most disliked. Look. President Clinton got through impeachment, had 70% approval rating the day he left office. This guy has had 8 years of a free ride from a Republican Congress, and six of those years, he's leaving with 75% disapproval. Explain that.
It's not over yet.
One out of two Republicans doesn't think he's doing a good job, Jack. Wake up.
I may have a bone to pick with you on who, if he is in fact the worst. I'm born and raised... very close to Warren G. Harding territory, and you know, even the people there didn't want anything to do with Warren G. Harding. They think he's
yeah.
So I don't know.
You want to talk about Teapot Dome? I don't have my Teapot Dome notes.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry. Well, I do.
I don't think we've ever had such a bad foreign policy misadventure as we have in Iraq.
And
about whether you thought we should go in there or not, or whether you think the surge is working. How badly it's been managed between 2003 and 2008.
You see the debate last night? You see him ask all the candidates?
Yeah.
And all of them except
none of them want to stand.
Yeah, no, it's a good idea. It was a good idea to go.
It's funny.
Yeah, every one of them said it.
We say these things so quickly. I remember after 9/11, the Democrats, Julian included, I think even on Larry King he said this, they stood up and they said, you know, we'll get behind Ridge, but we're going to hold Ridge and Bush strictly accountable for the safety of the homeland. We're going to judge you on how well you do in protecting this country. No attacks in 7 years. I never hear any credit for George Bush on that.
Maybe a little bit of track, maybe a little bit of credit on that, but a whole lot of legitimate criticism about the failure to connect all of the dots before 9/11. You know, in the Clinton administration, they tried to blow up a dozen planes from the Philippine plot, the Millennium bombing, all these other things, and because you had Clinton and the administration meeting with the counterterrorism officials on a weekly basis. Bush didn't meet with the counterterrorism folks for the first nine months of his presidency.
So yeah, that's
they
that's
were asleep at the switch in the first nine
well,
months.
Well, they did stop that Miami 7 over there.
Right.
That was
and
that
Chicago.
And Chicago.
Right.
There's some pretty bad groups right there.
Right.
If they'd have had $50 between them, they could have done something.
I don't know how you blame. I mean, I don't want to get too off the beaten path here, but I mean, I don't know how Bush was in office 6 months. 7 months when 9/11 happened. If you want to get into blaming people for 9/11, I don't think you can blame George Bush. Clinton had 8 years leading up to that. If there's blame to go around, I don't think it's on the Bush White House.
Well, just a little matter of being warned about it down at the ranch. I want to thank both of you guys for being on the program today. It's a pleasure. I know you got to move on. Pleasure talking to both of you.
Guy, thank you.
Julian, if you can do. Please, something to try and work on him a little bit. I know you guys are friends.
He's been trying for many years.
It
just doesn't work.
There are terminal cases. Jack, thanks so much for being on the program. Jack Berkman, Republican strategist, and Julian Epstein, Democratic standards strategist and activist, thanks so much for
thanks,
being
brother.
On the program.
Okay.
We're going to pause for a break. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Head On Radio Network.
Harry Potter has given us all a unique glimpse at education the way it ought to be. Never once do Harry and his Hogwarts friends talk about skipping class, ducking tough instructors, waiving requirements, or shirking responsibilities. That perspective, be practical, get it the easiest, fastest, cheapest way you can, is what J.K. Rowling terms the Muggle approach to education. We're Concord University, and do we have a deal for you? At Concord, education's different than anywhere else around. There's a reason that Concord students get the best jobs, are sought out by the best medical, graduate, and law schools in the land. It's no wonder that Concord has been cited by U.S. News & World Report and by the Wall Street Journal. Where do I sign up? At Southern West Virginia's version of Track 9 and 3 Quarters, all you have to do is believe, and believe in yourself. Concord University, an education you can put to work. 1-888-384-5249.
America's most dangerous investigative reporter, Greg Palast, joins Bob Kincaid for a bit of conversation radio.
But I have to tell you, this is such a pleasure to be able to actually lay it out.
Greg, anytime you want to lay it out, okay? We're reinventing things here. We call it conversation radio. We're very serious about that. And anytime you've got one of those that's a bit of a Gordian knot, bring it here, please, because there are people hungry for information and who are willing to, you know, this is not the Fox audience. We actually sit and think about stuff.
I like it. That's why I like this. It's the head-on radio network as opposed to the head-off television
right.
network that we've been suffering with. So I do appreciate your work, and let's set up another time. Take it easy, buddy.
Indeed. Take care, Greg. Thank you so much.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, weeknights, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, here on America's Liberal Voice, the Head On Radio Network.
Got a pony dog craving for a fire.
Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
This is the Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
Ah, yes, indeed. You're listening to the show here on the Head On Radio Network. And by the way, a proud member of the Head On Radio Network. We've got so many good things in the works for all of our great listeners. We are proud of what we do on this network. I'm proud of each and everybody on this network. And it's not like we all necessarily have to see eye and eye on eye and eye. Can't talk today. Eye to eye on every issue, and we don't. But we put forth the issues that are important to America. And just like being here at this health conference, what's more important than that right now? We've got the war. We've got that. We've got the economy going to hell in a handbasket. You can hear those issues discussed and discussed intelligently here every single day on Radio Network, and it really does my heart good to know I'm part of this group. We're waiting for our next interview right now. I don't know another one of those things we don't know exactly when they're going to show up. There is what you have to understand. If you've never been to a radio row, let me explain it just a little bit. We're here at the Mayflower and have this huge promenade stretching from Connecticut Avenue all the way over to 17th. It goes clear through the whole block. And there's this huge, wide promenade corridor with big chandeliers hanging and mirrors on the way. It's a fabulous-looking facility. And I'd say it's maybe 80 yards long, maybe longer. And both sides are lined with tables and show radio hosts. And, you know, you just don't know who you're going to find out here. We got John Elliott across from me. We've got Christine Brown from Air America. And we you don't know who's going to show up. But there are probably 8 to 10 show hosts here. And when the guests come in, they move from one show to another right down the line, so everybody's audiences gets a good crack at them, and that's just the way it works. So our next guest right now, Bernie Horn, he's not here yet, so here we are, high and dry. But that always happens at these things anyway. So let's talk a little bit about last night. How many of you saw that great debate last night? I must tell you, as shocked as I am sometimes about things that Republicans say, and I've tried to keep this show a little bit nonpartisan today because a lot of these people get funding from foundations that are not necessarily partisan. But I watched that debate last night, and it was just absolutely shocking to me. And I'm not easily shocked by these Republicans today on some of the things they say. But when they went down the line last night, and I think it was Russert that asked the question, yes or no, do you think the Iraq War was a good idea? And, of course, you know Ron Paul said no. But I swear, When Romney, when McCain, and that fool Giuliani, all said that yes, they thought the Iraq War was a good idea. I was left speechless. You would think that one of them would have the honesty to stand up and say no, it wasn't. I mean, Ron Paul, I'll leave him out of it, but. Have the honesty to stand up and the character to stand up and say, no, it wasn't a good idea. We've lost almost 1,000 Americans. We've lost God knows how many innocent Iraqis in this. And we've got the Muslim community dead set against the United States government now and probably the American people. It's fascinating to me that anybody could stand up and say that this was a good idea. I just think it is absolutely shocking that somebody could say that. I really do. I expected them to dance. I expected them to obfuscate on the whole thing and make excuses, do anything. But I did not really expect to have a clear answer from any of them, yes or no, was the Iraq War a good idea, and have them come back and say yes. If you don't think that you're getting George Bush's third term by voting for any one of those clowns that was on there last night, then you're just sadly mistaken, because it's going to be more George Bush by any one of them. And like I've said all along, and I don't think at this point, I hope my political acumen is what I think it is, I don't think we're going to have to worry about Giuliani. I hope Florida, my home state, puts his campaign to sleep. I do, because that man has worried me tremendously, and I don't mind telling you, and I have told you all along, that the thought of a Rudy Giuliani presidency frightens me for the future of this nation. Frightens me. It's not that I just disagree with his policies. Rudy Giuliani frightens me. So I think that he's going to be out of it very, very shortly, and we'll be faced with Romney and McCain, and then God knows where it's going to go from there. It's going to be interesting to see how the Florida primary shakes out next week. It appears that Giuliani is cooked McCain and Romney are running a very close race there. I just don't know. I wouldn't want to say right now how the race is going to go between Romney and McCain. It appears from the polls, if you can believe the polls anymore, and we had a long discussion here today over lunch of what just happened. Had somebody tell me today that they honestly and truly believe, and it's somebody I respect a great deal, and I won't mention his name because maybe he can help me to impart this information to you, but I had somebody who's well known in Washington, D.C. political circles, believe me, tell me with a straight face and in all seriousness that he absolutely believes, and I don't know if I agree with this or not, but he said he knows, he absolutely agrees that the Republicans threw that race in New Hampshire over to Hillary Clinton, that they hacked the machines and pushed it over because they knew that would stop the momentum from Obama, and so are the rest of you that cynical? Do we think now, are we to the point where we think the Republicans actually have the ability to throw an entire election? And that's notwithstanding what happened in Ohio, the last election, not what happened in Florida. Some close races there. But this time around, it appears that maybe it wouldn't be close. Do they really have the ability to push whatever Democratic candidate they want up against their candidate? Do they have that ability? I wonder, and it scares me thinking that prominent people here, actually believe that the Republicans are able to do that. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm surprised by it. It just is such a huge disappointment. I don't want to think that, and there are lots of things I don't want to think that are true. But I just have always had enough faith in the American way of life and the American political system, regardless of our differences with the Republicans. I just always have had enough faith that maybe it wasn't that pervasive. Maybe there were a handful of people someplace pulling the strings, and maybe the whole party didn't feel that way, whatever. But to think that to think they're able to do that, actually, that scares me. It really does. And it's like Bob says in the chat room right now, that Republicans have been aching to run against Hillary Clinton. Last night, if you heard the debate, that's the only name they mentioned. I didn't hear him mention Edwards. I didn't hear him mention any other candidate, Obama, last night. I just heard him say, Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. That's what they want. They want that fight. If that's the fight we end up with, okay, whatever Democratic candidate, because I do not want the status quo to survive politically in this country. There's got to be change. There's got to be a huge change. This is a watershed moment for the United States of America. Don't kid yourselves, and I don't think anybody that's serious about maintaining the American way of life. I don't think that most of those people that don't, but I think they do believe this is a watershed moment. It's one of those sink or swim times, and I can't see. I just can't see the American way of life surviving if we go through another one or two terms of the type of presidency and the type of administrations that we've suffered through during George W. Bush. I can't imagine it, and I think it'd be the death knell for our way of life in this country if we do end up with something like that. I honestly do. We're going to take this opportunity to take a short break and see if we can round up our next guest. You're listening to The Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, coming to you live from the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C.
The Head On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It wasn't exactly planes, trains, and automobiles on Head On with Bob Kincaid.
This is what the Bush administration Justice Department didn't want you to see back in 2001. They took out and they huffed the marker a little bit, and then they went, oh, cool. And they wiped out the name where it says, the plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royalty family or Osama bin Laden. Somebody's got to call up and say, good afternoon. Thank you for calling Ryan International Flights. How may I help you?
Hello. This is Osama bin Laden, and I would like to rent a Boeing 727. Do you have one handy?
Oh, just a moment. Let me check. It's a Mr. bin Laden wants to know if we got a 727. Do we, Harry, do we have a 727?
Yeah, we got a 727 just sitting there on the lot. Going cheap.
There's nothing here. Nothing to look at. Keep moving. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The 6'7" Arab with the portable dialysis machine and the white robes.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, weeknights, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, only on the Head On Radio Network.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
Nah. You just got to find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4, and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers, so that becomes an 8, too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Welcome back to the Guy James Show. Thank you for everybody joining us in the program. We've got a great audience today, and always a pleasure to bring you the most up-to-the-minute items that that inform and affect all of you. And we, being at this health conference, of course, that's something that affects whether Jack wanted to admit it or not. It is something that affects all of us. And right now we've got our next guest with us. We've got Kelly Middleton. Kelly is the current health policy fellow at the Green Uniting Institute in Berkeley, California. Kelly, yes. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You know, it fascinates me. Several people that we've talked to here, at, you're a health policy fellow.
Yes.
From the University of Notre Dame, and you have your master's of public health. You're so young.
Thank you.
How do you get all that accomplished being this young?
A lot. I take in a lot and just throw myself in different environments, and I think I've definitely done that in policy. And so it keeps you young when policy changes as quickly as it does.
Well, I've got to get more involved. I need something to keep me a little younger. I don't know. It's not working for me. Kelly, tell us a little bit about your organization.
Greenlining is a multi-ethnic public policy research and advocacy organization. We work on behalf of low-income the minority community, focusing on minority empowerment and increasing civic participation. We work in actually many different areas. We have housing, sustainable development, banking, telecommunications, consumer protection, and health. And the biggest issue right now, in addition to higher education, and the biggest issue right now in health and what's going on in California is the health care reform debate, which is kind of the highlight of health policy right now, of all policy in California that we're focusing on, and specifically within that, how it relates to and how it influences low-income communities.
Well, so many people talk about health care as though it's just a single issue,
right?
And forget how it just weaves in with so many other things. It has
exactly.
to do with poverty.
Exactly.
It has to do with education. It has to do with so many things.
Exactly.
And so many people treat it as though, well, today we just have a health care issue, and that's all. Well, you can't separate them out.
Not at all, and that's actually one reason why there's so many, and I think an important reason, different components to the Greenlining Institute. Housing, all the social determinants of health. Housing we take care of, education, higher education, affordability, sustainable development with energy. There's in the legal academy, we have a legal academy, consumer protection. There's all sorts of efforts on all of our team's parts that contribute and kind of intertwine back within health because they're all determinants of health, and they all have an influence on the health of populations that we serve.
Why you work primarily in communities of color?
Yes. And for communities of color, not necessarily within them all the time, but for them.
Not within, okay. Why is it a bigger issue? Explain to the audience, why is it a bigger issue, and I believe it is a bigger
yes.
issue, in the minority communities and in the communities of color than it is elsewhere?
It may not even be that it's a bigger issue. It's just that if you look at the statistics, the disparities that are out right now, the literature, the research, everything that's being done, the birth rates, the mortality rates, cardiovascular disease, diabetes within minority communities, and you compare that to Caucasian communities, you will see stark differences. These discrepancies, these disparities contribute and further perpetuate if nothing is being done on a political level and within the communities themselves on a local level and an institutional level. That's why it's so important, because you did bring out the fact that, yes, you know, why is it so important for within minority communities and the attention be brought to these issues, because they affect everyone, not just those with darker skin, but they affect our entire nation if there are disparities and continue to exist inequalities in the healthcare system.
We had do you know Ruth Perot?
No.
We had Ruth Perot on the program yesterday, and she told us a statistic, and the reason I wanted mm-hmm. to lead you into this is why this is of such importance in minority and communities of color. Told me, and maybe my listeners will get tired of me mentioning this, because I mentioned it about three times yesterday, but mm-hmm. it's something that stuck with me, and if I take home one fact from this whole conference, is that she told me that amongst people of color
yes.
that have diabetes,
yes.
90% of the lower extremity amputations in this country, 90%
mm-hmm.
are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I just blown away by that.
And a lot of people don't even realize that.
I didn't. Not to that extent.
They don't have the numbers. They don't have, and it's not even a matter of numbers. It's just knowing that there are differences in the healthcare system, the hospital system. Same with cardiovascular disease. You have huge discrepancies in treatment with asthma, the same thing, and prescribing a surgery, okay? African Americans are not as likely to be prescribed a surgery, a treatment form for cardiovascular disease and heart surgery, as whites are. It's a known fact, and that
Why?
Makes sense. Why? That's a long, I mean, the answers and the reasons for that, we could go on and on about the contributing factors towards disparities, and it would take a while. None of them are substantial enough. They have to do with the institution as well as a lot of other factors that take place within medicine. It would literally be a radio show in itself
sure.
to bring that on.
Well, I'm blown away by some
yes.
of the figures that I see.
It's disturbing.
Access to health care.
Yes.
I think, I watched a program. I'm not sure which. I can't remember the program recently, but it was about access to health care
mm-hmm.
in L.A.
Okay.
And about homeless people
yeah.
and people of color having access to health care. I don't think a lot of people understand that not everybody has equal access to just walk on the street to a high-end clinic or hospital.
Right. The uninsurance rates and the underinsurance rates within the country are disturbing, let alone within California. The new health care proposals that are going through hearings right now, committee hearings, and being voted upon, ABX11 specifically, are going to ensure, I think, out of the number of uninsured right now, half will become insured. 71%, actually more than that, will be now insured under this program, under this proposal, half of which are minority communities, low-income minority communities. People don't understand how devastating it is where you can have someone living next to you, a community down the block, they don't have the same access to care as you. They can't go into the doctor. They don't have a doctor. They can't get drugs, you know, medications that they may need because they don't have that access. Furthermore, even if they are enrolled in a program, Medi-Cal, they don't necessarily receive the same care as someone who is not enrolled, let alone as someone who is enrolled in a different program. So you can have insurance and still not receive a standard quality of care, still not have that access to certain benefits or access to procedures and medications, and still be enrolled in a program.
You know what I don't understand, leaving the selfishness out of all this, mm-hmm. and people that aren't necessarily interested in having everybody have decent health care and access
right.
to decent health care, leaving the selfishness out of it, and there's certainly a component of that in
right.
there. Don't people understand that the health and welfare of everybody in their community does affect them?
Right.
It does affect them.
Right.
Communicable disease.
Exactly.
You know, it's like you send your kid to school and you've got health insurance and the kid sitting next to him doesn't.
They don't
he
have,
comes
right.
infected with the flu or whatever. Forget the greedy part. Gee whiz, think about the part, well, I better start, you know, it'll help me.
That's exactly right. The health of an individual influences the health of a community, which influences the health of the nation. So it should be, in everyone's mind, whether it's selfish or not, or altruistic, a priority that my neighbor has health insurance, that my neighbor has access to a doctor, that I have access to a doctor if something were to happen. It should be. I agree completely with you that even from a selfish standpoint, it makes sense that people have access to health care.
So many people don't know what the word community means, and that's something that America has to work on,
mm-hmm.
That word community, that word society.
Right.
We forget, and I think everybody this conference hasn't forgotten us
right. right
here.
Right.
What are you working on right now? What are you trying to, you know, the broad goal of your organization now?
Like I said, the broader goal of our organization, as always, is minority empowerment through whatever field, whatever division, and specifically within health. One of my main focus is in regards to healthcare reform, the increased number of people that will now who were uninsured or underinsured that are now guaranteed. Insurance under a new proposal. There's going to be problems down the line as far as access because there's an expected physician shortage within California by 2015, within the nation by 2020. Access to healthcare workers, to physicians, to doctors. So what I'm focusing on specifically is improving the number of minorities represented in our health schools. Now, even more specifically, at the California medical school level. The number of minorities who are present who will influence the future of access, who will influence the future of delivery of health care to these now insured populations who otherwise would not have had that. Research has shown that minority physicians are more likely to serve in underserved communities and underserved populations. Their patients have greater risk for disease and disease complications, and they're mostly minority. Research has shown that minority physicians tend to go back to the minority communities, and that's where they set up their shop. That's where they work. So by increasing the number of minorities that are in the health workforce, in addition to increasing the number of physicians, period, and nurses and dentists and health professionals, period, this could heavily influence how healthcare is delivered to those populations who were once underserved or once overlooked.
You're a step ahead of me. That's one thing I wanted to ask about now. Is it just something inherent? imagine anybody be a better spokesman for your group, and I wish you all the success in the world with
thank you very much.
Your career in medicine. What are you going to do?
I'm open to a lot. I definitely have my interests. I have my passions, but I'm staying open to everything, and I think that I will definitely focus on minority health and the initiatives within policy and the medical field as a physician, as a practicing physician.
Thanks so much for being
Thank
with us.
Thank you.
Kelly Middleton from the Health Policy, she's a Health Policy Fellow at the Green Dining Institute in Berkeley, California. Kelly, thanks so much for being with us here on the Guy James Show. Yeah, we had a slight glitch there for just a moment. I hope you it's the fun of being at these conferences. Everything's on the fly. I do want to thank everybody for being with us today, and I know... what an important issue this is in the world. Some of you, it's a matter of getting everybody to where they need to be. And believe me, this nation is not where it needs to be. As I said many times, I don't think we necessarily have a health care system. I think we have a sick system in this country, and it needs to be fixed. When you spend approximately $7,500 on every man, woman, and child in this country on health care, and you still have 47 million people approximately uninsured, that is just absolutely criminal. It is. And to listen, and you know how political I am, and you know how biased I am, and a partisan I am. Bias is the wrong word. I am partisan. When you listen to a debate, like I listened to last night, and you see one side of the political spectrum not even mention it, you know that there's a serious, serious problem in this country. You know that there's a polarity that it's got to stop. And somehow, and just like I mentioned with Kelly a moment ago, your neighbor's health care is your problem, too. You've got to understand that. Everybody's got to understand that. And somehow we need to get that message out to everybody. Your whole community's health care is something that it's everybody's problem. Everybody's problem. So please, you know, spread that message. And it's something that we'll take home from this conference this week, that there are so many people out working so hard on this issue, just working so hard on it, and we certainly hope that will continue. We are going to head back to South Florida tomorrow, and we'll be back with our show on Tuesday, as always. We've got some great guests coming up. I have the author, and I don't have his name here right now, but Confessions of a Political Hitman, new book coming out, and I have the author on the show next week. I believe it's Tuesday. I don't know that I've read a more interesting book in a long time, somebody, a political hitman, kind of a reformed political hitman, let's put it this way. So I want to thank everybody once again for listening to the show. I want to thank you for your interest in the healthcare issue, and I want to thank everybody listening You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and don't you dare forget, you've heard from the radical right. You heard a little bit of it today from Jack Berkman. Now all that's left is the truth. See you later, gang. Thank you.